Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, April 18th, 2010, here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is the winner of the second Izzy Award for Independent Journalism, Jeremy Scahill, joining us for the entire hour today in Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Mobile phone service in America is more expensive, has slower data speeds, and is less reliable than in many other countries. Slate.com technology writer Farhad Manju says that it's time for a cell phone bill of rights. First on the list, you have a right to know your drop call rate. We need data about mobile networks, most of which is now kept secret.
What I envision is that the FCC would kind of mandate that companies make public the data that in most cases they already have, things like dropped call rates, network load, much more granular data about where they have cell towers, and also how their service varies for different devices that they use. You know, it's sort of like the data that we get about gas efficiency in cars. You can make a decision based on those numbers.
Second, you have the right to return your phone. All major mobile carriers now offer a 30-day grace period on their phones. Manju says more consumers should make use of that policy.
The problem with this rule is that very few people know about it, and it's not usually stated on the contract in a way that makes it noticeable to people. So I would like, if it was more prominent, if the salesman told you about it, you know, I think that it would be nice if we had some regulation around this.
Manju's third right is the right to understand your bill. He'd like to see phone companies simplify their confounding bills in a way that's similar to what credit card companies are now mandated to do. State information in clear and concise terms, with all companies using the same format. And the last right on the list? You have the right to unlock your phone. When you buy a phone bundled with a plan, companies lock the phone so that you can't take it to another carrier, and they can recoup the discounted price of the phone over the life of the contract. But carriers don't unlock the phone after the contract is completed, and they keep charging you for the phone.
After 2 years, they don't reduce the rate that you're paying, even though you've paid off the cell phone. It seems to sort of defy common sense that you pay exactly the same rate after 2 years that you were paying, even though you sort of essentially have fulfilled your contract and you have now kind of paid off the discounted cell phone.
You can read Manju's column at Slate.com.
If you happened to catch the second annual Streamy Awards online last week, you would have seen several well-known actors and media makers wearing white ribbons in support of net neutrality, the fundamental and endangered principle that keeps the internet open and free from discrimination. The Streamies honor excellence in original online programming. Chris McCaleb, director, writer, and producer at BigFantastic.com, hatched the idea for the ribbons with a few colleagues after hearing a federal court had ruled that the FCC has no authority to regulate broadband services.
It seemed like a perfect opportunity to get people talking and get people thinking about it and get people learning, because I think a lot of people hear the words net neutrality and their heads start spinning. They don't necessarily understand how it impacts every single one of us, and not only in our industry, but everyone across the world.
McCaleb Special ordered 1,100 ribbons and enlisted friends to help him piece them together with stickers the day before the event. Dressed in his suit, he hand-carried the ribbons and punch bowls through downtown streets in Hollywood to the glitzy event on Sunday night.
I was blown away every time somebody came up on stage. It was so exciting that people are getting it and they're getting the message.
McCaleb says that the open environment of the internet has made it possible for writers, producers, and performers to create entertainment that just wouldn't be possible otherwise.
Now you have the ability to build your own brand or your own channel to interact with your audience in a way that you just can't do in traditional media and to own the content that you create. And that's unprecedented. You know, the fear is, without net neutrality, if the big telecoms are able to restrict the space, to create, as they say on Save the Internet, a slow lane and a fast lane, if they can just up and block a website because maybe it conflicts with something that they're putting out, some of their content. That's a really scary idea for people like myself who are creating things independently. And I think that you'd really start to lose those independent voices.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today has been on the show before, and we're honored to have him back again today. He is the winner of the second Izzy Award, named after I.F. Stone, for the Outstanding Independent Journalist of the Year, and someone well-known to many of our listeners is the author of the book on Blackwater, the award-winning book, and as a journalist, investigative journalist, has been covering issues of war and peace in U.S. foreign policy for the past 10 or 15 years. Jeremy Scahill, welcome to Media Matters.
It's good to be back with you, Bob.
Well, you know, there's so much to talk about, and I think the place I'd like to just start before we go into the Izzy and the independent journalism and issues like that is for listeners who are unfamiliar with your trailblazing and award-winning book on Blackwater, and I know there are some out there who are, if you would just say a few words basically about what Blackwater is, what they did, what your book was about, as much as you could sum it up, just to get everyone up to speed.
Sure. Well, you know, I think the first thing to say about it is that if you step back and you look at the bigger picture of what has happened with the U.S. war machine, basically from the time of Bill Clinton to the present, what you've seen is this explosion or expansion in the use of private military contractors, as they're often called. Many of these so-called contractors, though, are actually mercenaries. And what's happening is that the United States government has become entirely reliant upon private soldiers to fight its wars. And we see that in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And Blackwater is a company that really was the leading force in rebranding mercenaries as legitimate forces that could be used by powerful governments around the world to occupy other countries or conquer them. And what's particularly of interest about Blackwater, which has about 20,000 men on call at any given moment to go into an armed conflict or to work for a Fortune 500 corporation or a government other than the United States, as well as the United States government, is that the owner of Blackwater really became a mega powerful figure during the Bush administration. He himself is an evangelical Catholic who is, in the words of some of his own employees in sworn affidavits, an avowed Christian supremacist who views his job in the world as trying to literally destroy Islam and wipe out Muslims around the globe. This was a man whose private army was hired by the Bush administration to work for the CIA, the State Department, and the Pentagon in Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, Blackwater forces were among the first to be sent into Afghanistan in the early stages of U.S. post-9/11 operations there. Well, you fast forward to the present time, and the reality is that Blackwater remains on the U.S. government payroll under the administration of Barack Obama, where Blackwater right now is the elite bodyguard service for Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. When Richard Holbrooke or Hillary Clinton travel to the region, they're guarded in part by Blackwater forces. Blackwater men were killed at the bombing of the CIA outpost late last year in Khost, Afghanistan, where the CIA was supposed to be working with what U.S. intelligence officials described as the golden goose of intelligence, this Jordanian double agent who had supposedly just met with Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Qaeda's number two figure. Two Blackwater men were killed when this meeting was happening, showing how central they remain to sensitive U.S. operations in war zones around the world. So, in short, to describe Blackwater is actually to tell the story of a military-industrial complex that was envisioned and condemned by Dwight Eisenhower turned into a Frankenstein program where now you have more contractors deployed on the U.S. government payroll in Afghanistan than U.S. soldiers. And these are companies that in some cases are publicly traded, mercenary companies. I mean, the founding fathers of this country must be turning over in their graves the idea that mercenary companies can be traded on the open market in the United States, but that's what's happened in this country. It's a bipartisan program, and it continues under the Obama administration, Bob.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill, you've just been listening to. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Just to remind you or let you know that this is a pre-recorded show with Jeremy Scahill. So don't call in today. Sit back and let Jeremy Scahill and me do the yakking today. Jeremy Scahill will be in Ithaca, New York tomorrow night to accept the Izzy Award for the Outstanding Journalist offered by Ithaca College's Park School there. And if you want to learn about the Izzy Award named after Eye of Stone, go to ithaca.edu/indy, I-N-D-Y, and you'll learn all there is about it. Jeremy Scahill, when you talk about mercenaries, and I think it's astonishing, I don't think many Americans still are aware of the fact that in Afghanistan and I believe Iraq too, there are more private contractors doing what were once military functions entirely until the last decade or 15 years than there are actual U.S. soldiers. So the real numbers of deployment are vastly larger. Are the figures for deaths and injuries in the war that are suffered by private contractors, are those included in the death figures we get in the news media?
No, they're not. In fact, I sort of a couple times a year make an inquiry with the U.S. Department of Labor, which is where the claims are filed when contractors are on the U.S. government payroll are killed. The families of contractors can file for federal death benefits, regardless of what the nationality is of the deceased contractor. So, let me explain what I mean by that. If you are a 30-year-old man from Jordan, the nation of Jordan, and you take on employment with KBR, KBR is technically mandated by U.S. law to provide that individual with insurance under the Defense Base Act of the United States. That goes back to the 1940s and actually was aimed at protecting longshoremen when they would work abroad. But then companies like AIG are the providers of this insurance. So then the company KBR, when the individual dies, gets reimbursed by federal taxpayers for the benefits that they're paying out and AIG is ultimately making a profit off of. So the short and simple answer to this is that one of the great benefits or the political expedience factor of using contractors is that no one talks about their deaths, and only when journalists call the Department of Labor and say, hey, how many filings for benefits did you have under the Defense Base Act last year for deaths in Iraq or Afghanistan, or in the last quarter for deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan, do you even get a tiny fraction of the number of people killed? So those whose families know that they can apply for these benefits, that's the only way we can track how many contractors have been killed. And, Bob, at least 2,000 contractors have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is a substantial percentage of the number of overall deaths if you actually look at the totals in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it masks the true extent of the killing of U.S.-funded personnel or the deaths of U.S.-funded personnel. It's a way to tamp down any kind of public opposition because there's a lot more bodies coming back than the media report and that the government will own up to.
Jeremy Scahill, one of the things that is striking about Blackwater and about the mercenary program, I tried to look and find the defenses or explanations or rationales for privatizing this, and I have trouble finding them because I assume that most of them are predicated on the idea that this will create more efficiency and save money for taxpayers and that sort of stuff, but all the evidence suggests that these are just huge crony capitalist giveaway programs.
Well, I mean, the original idea for the current manifestation of the privatization of war actually was cooked up by that great genius Dick Cheney. When he was the defense secretary under George H.W. Bush, what he did in his final days in office was to hire a division of Halliburton, the company he would then go on to head through much of the 1990s. He hired a division of Halliburton to do a study on how to privatize as much of the military bureaucracy as possible. And the idea there was that you were going to create a competitive factor that would result in the best possible product to support U.S. military operations abroad, building the best tent cities, serving the best food, having the best vehicles, everything except the fighting of the war. And the idea was that you're going to get this great product, and as a bonus, you're going to be able to free up all the soldiers that would normally be peeling potatoes or doing laundry to do the actual fighting of wars. Well, what Cheney then proceeded to do, and what Clinton, Bill Clinton helped him in doing, was to create this incredibly lucrative market for Halliburton to service the U.S. military abroad, and instead of doing it in a competitive way where you would have multiple bids, they began the process of giving out no-bid contracts. While saying that this was going to be a better product because of competition, they set up a system with the least competitive process. And that has endured through the present time. The Obama administration has, and I do give them credit for this, has been taking certain moves to stop the rampant use of no-bid contracts, but they still occur, and you have these mammoth monopolies now that operate in U.S. war zones that are guaranteed what are called cost-plus contracts, where they are guaranteed a profit regardless of the performance of their duties or the quality of the product that they perform. So while the official rationale has to do with a better product, what we've seen time and again is that the recipients of no-bid contracts serve dirty water to the troops. They have installed electrical facilities that are not up to code, that have electrocuted U.S. soldiers and contractors alike. They've engaged in environmentally destructive practices. And in the case of the armed contractors like Blackwater, have engaged in such systematic misconduct that it has taken the lives of countless civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also has caused blowback against official U.S. troops who get blamed for the misconduct or killing that is carried out by Blackwater and other armed contractors. So you could calculate this in terms of the dollar amount and say these guys are not cheaper, or you could calculate it in the accounting world of morality and say that the damage they've done to the United States far exceeds any good that they've done in protecting diplomat X or ambassador Y.
Jeremy Scahill, what for listeners and people like myself, interviewers, who have never been in a war, who've never been in a war zone as a journalist or as an observer in any way, and I know you've spent time in the Balkans, in the former Yugoslavia. And
Iraq as well.
And Iraq, yeah, going back to the 90s, though, and then in Iraq as well. You know, what is it about the wars, and especially now Iraq and Afghanistan, that probably we don't get at all from the news media coverage we are exposed to on cable news or newspapers or network news? What is, you know, if there were some things that are just completely absent that become evident once you show up in one of these countries, what would they be?
Well, I think, first of all, that we have to realize that the best journalism when it comes to international reporting that's being done in the world right now is largely not being done in the English language. You have had this rise, and it's really one of the great stories of recent media history. You've had this rise in the prominence of big Arabic language satellite channels, and you've had a sort of opening up of certain print media and blogs throughout the Arab and Muslim world. And just as our own sort of social media culture and blogosphere culture in this country, is filled with characters of every stripe, people that wouldn't know a fact if it hit them in the face, people that are propagandists for one party or another, people that are fanatics. You also have some tremendously talented and principled journalists that are operating now in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're not working in the English language, or that's not the primary place where their work is seen. And yet, if you watch Al Jazeera, or sometimes Al Arabiya, or you read the English language newspaper that's produced out of the Middle East called The National, where people like Nir Rosen publish their work, what you get is a very complicated picture of the on-the-ground politics in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as in Israel-Palestine, where the nuances of the politics are covered in a way where the consumer of the information is assumed to be intelligent, engaged, and desiring a diversity of opinion and information. What we're seeing now, and Bob, you and John Nichols have probably done more on this than anyone else, in our media culture in the United States, is a dumbing down of the news, this infotainment, the cutting back of budgets for foreign coverage. The American media consumer is assumed to be an imbecile. by those that are producing the news right now. And that's why we don't have real journalists on TV anymore. We have actors that are posing as journalists, pretending to play media for, you know, for a day or a week or a year. But the coverage in the Middle East by local journalists there is getting better and better, and we don't see it because media outlets in this country don't team up with them. If I was to give advice now to major corporate media outlets that actually wanted to provide information that was that amounted to actionable intelligence for media consumers in the United States, I would say team up with local journalists in the region where the United States is engaged in war or where the United States has some huge so-called interest there, because we would get a much more complete picture of what's happening on the ground. I know I'm going on a lot here, but I'll just give you two concrete examples, and that is the elections in both Afghanistan and Iraq. If you simply relied on the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News to tell you what was happening during the elections in Iraq and the elections in Afghanistan, you would come away with a very simplified picture of what happened. I mean, how many corporate media outlets reported that Iyad Alawi, who is struggling to take his place as the next prime minister of Iraq, is actually a man who's been accused of himself murdering unarmed, shackled prisoners when he was first installed years ago by George Bush as the first prime minister of the quote-unquote new Iraq. That is a story that went almost without mention in the U.S. press, and yet it was a huge deal in that region that Iyad Alawi, a former Ba'athist, a former CIA asset, is accused of having murdered unarmed prisoners, and that very well may be the next prime minister of Iraq. That just wasn't a story here, but it was huge in the region.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill, you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. This is a recorded show. We taped it a few days before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back and relax. Jeremy Scahill is the author of Blackwater, the award-winning book that came out 2007, Jeremy, is that right?
Yeah, the first time, and then we updated it at the end of 2008 because so many things had happened.
And he is also the winner of the second Izzy Award issued by the Park School at the Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. And the Izzy Award, named after I.S. Stone, the first year was given to Amy Goodman and Glenn Greenwald. This year to Jeremy Scahill. I think it's fair to say it has become the gold standard for independent journalism in the United States. And it's an honor to have Jeremy Scahill as our guest today on Media Matters. You know, Jeremy, you wrote the Blackwater book, and you've updated it. And, you know, it's difficult to support yourself as an independent journalist, I would imagine. And I would imagine also that books are the primary means that you have really earning much of an income to support yourself and to do your work. Is that true? I mean, what are the options available to you? I mean, how does one become a Jeremy Scahill if there's a 21-year-old person out there who says, I'd love to do what that guy's doing?
Well, you know, I mean, I'll just tell you it's sort of truncated version of how I ended up doing what I do, and that is that I basically stalked Amen, not in a creepy way, like in sort of a professional sense, in the mid-90s. It was the first time that I had ever heard Pacifica Radio, and it was right around the time in 2006 that Democracy Now! Went on the air, and my mind was just blown, Bob, by hearing. I had never heard anything like this. I mean, just the first 5 minutes of Democracy Now! Where they do the headlines, I wouldn't miss that, you know, for anything. I constantly would listen to that show, and I felt like it was like my lifeline to what was actually happening in the world. And I said, you know, I want to do that. I don't have a degree in journalism. I didn't even finish college. In fact, I was invited to speak at the journalism school at the University of Wisconsin, but they wouldn't even let me into the journalism school at the University of Wisconsin when I was there, and I had to correct the dean of the journalism program when they were bragging about me being an alum. I said, well, actually, I couldn't get into the journalism school. Which is, I mean, but it also goes to the idea, and I know that you've talked about this a bit too. You know, I think that journalism should be approached as a trade, like being a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter. It's a get your fingernails dirty, your hands are going to be rough profession if you're doing it right. But it also should be a service to people, like plumbers provide a service or electricians. This shouldn't be something for, you know, these royalists like Peggy Noonan who, you know, sit on their mountain in their mansion hoping the poor can never break through their gates. It should be something for people who roll their sleeves up and want to get, you know, get down into the muck with ordinary folks and victims and others. So I basically just begged Amy Goodman and said, you know, if you have a dog, I'll walk your dog, I'll wash your windows, I'll do anything you want me to do. I just want to be a part of this thing. And finally, after a few months of her relentless pursuit, she agreed to let me come in and volunteer. This was in 97. And I basically, sat in this closet clipping articles about the coming bombing of Iraq that Bill Clinton carried out in 1998. And I stayed there for 14 hours the first day and sort of never left. And Amy started paying me, I think it was $40 out of her pocket every day to help write the news headlines in the morning. So at the time I was a chain smoker. I would get there at 4:30 in the morning. She would give me money to buy every newspaper, and I would literally just cut them out and then paste them, and I would edit out the bad politics and rewrite them in the margins for Amy to read the news headlines off of the wire copy or what have you. We didn't really have computers. We were so low budget. And then I started begging people that I knew that had, I thought they were rich, but I thought $500 was like this huge amount of money at the time. I was staying at the Catholic Worker in New York, and I started begging people for money to support traveling to go and do small journalism projects. So I went to Iraq with $1,500 the first time and felt like I was rich, that I had $1,500 in my pocket, and stayed in Iraq for about a month just traveling around. And I kind of learned journalism under Amy Goodman and Democracy Now, but I learned it as a trade. And I think that when you have that passion burning in your heart and you want to do it, and you're in a position where you're not forced to think about the money, you actually can learn it as a trade. And so I remember feeling so excited the first time I had an article published on Common Dreams or Antiwar.com or Alternet. I mean, I thought, wow, this is the life. I didn't get paid a dime for any of that stuff, but I was so proud of the fact that I was actually working in journalism. I didn't make any money, like actual money as a journalist, probably until a few years ago. I only was able to get health benefits about a year ago. So, I mean, if you say to somebody, well, what do you want to do to be like Jeremy? I mean, in retrospect, it was kind of an insane thing to do. You run around the world with $1,500 in your pocket writing for free, filing tax returns for $14,000 a year isn't necessarily the way to, build a career. But the point is, it's not supposed to be a career. At journalism at its best, this kind of journalism should be a way of life, actually. And a calling rather than, viewing it as how do you climb the editorial structure at Condé Nast Enterprises.
So your advice then to that 21-year-old student who desperately has read your book, reads you online, listens to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! And says, this is what I want to do, is what?
Well, no, I wouldn't say to people, like, don't go to journalism school or you should drop out of school and do what I did, because I have to say that I also lucked out. I mean, Amy Goodman of 1997 was not the Amy Goodman of today. Democracy Now! Was on, I think, 20 radio stations when I happened to roll in there. I mean, I benefited from tremendously good timing in who my mentor ended up being, and the fact that Amy Goodman remains very loyal to her people and really, helps. I mean, Amy would train people back in the day. Nowadays, I think she's too busy to do that kind of direct training. So I acknowledge I lucked out with some of the people that I got to be around, and I think you couldn't rep that. But what I'm saying is that if you're thinking of journalism as a career where you want to try to make a living, that's going to be a problem in today's journalistic culture. It's really hard to make ends meet. You have to be willing to probably work side jobs in order to do real journalism. And so, my advice to people who are just starting out, walk into your local community radio station or cable access station and get involved with something, even if you have to cobble it together yourself, that resembles an apprenticeship. Get out of the classroom as much as possible and into the field. If there's a journalist that you admire, it never hurts to write them and say, I can volunteer 10 hours a week for you to help research, or even reply to emails for you, or do whatever. Just put yourself around the people who you look up to. Even if you're doing menial tasks, the fact that you're around them, and if they're decent people, is going to pay off in the long run, because you're going to get that feel for what it's like to be doing this kind of work. So I would say proximity to the people that you admire, and also getting involved with your local media. You don't have to go to New York City and walk into Democracy Now!'s office. You can do it in Champaign, Urbana, or elsewhere. There are independent media outlets. Become the media, and I don't mean that as a cliche. What I did was I walked into WBAI and I started editing tape for people. And I was volunteering for Democracy Now!, and I had no idea that I would ever end up being able to do this for a living, but it was my dream, and I just wanted to be on it.
Our guest today, Jeremy Scahill, you've just been listening to, author of Blackwater, independent journalist, and winner of the 2010 Izzy Award, named after Eye of Stone, the second such award, but already really the gold standard for independent journalism in the United States. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a few days before going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Jeremy, let's get back to Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, sort of the war zone of the United States right now. And I want to get back to the issue of sort of the mainstream press coverage of that war and sort of what Americans who are citizens who sincerely want to know what's going on, the raw material they're given to work with by our commercial news media. And your sense as someone who's there and has written about this, you know, what is missing in the mainstream news accounts on cable news and the New York Times and Washington Post and Time magazine that you're seeing when you're over there that, that people really need to know about?
Well, you know, I a very good friend of mine is one of the best young journalists that is a U.S. citizen. His name is Rick Rowley, and I would bet that the vast overwhelming majority of people listening to this show have never heard of Rick Rowley, and that's because and Rick Rowley is probably the U.S. journalist with the most unembedded war experience in the so-called war on terror. He has spent more time in Afghanistan and Iraq at this point, probably unembedded, not with U.S. soldiers, than any other U.S. journalist. And the reason you've never heard of him is because he can't get hired to work at CNN. He doesn't work for MSNBC or Fox or any of the networks. Rick Rowley, whose work you might have seen on Democracy Now!, primarily works for Al Jazeera. And he works for Al Jazeera Arabic, even though he's not fluent in Arabic. And he works for Al Jazeera English, and he does phenomenal reports that Democracy Now! Occasionally airs. But you don't get to see Rick Rowley on corporate TV in this country because Rick Rowley's reports are too complicated. Rick Rowley's reports are not American-centric. His reports look at how is this war impacting ordinary people? Who are the warlords that the U.S. is backing in Afghanistan? Those are stories that you can't touch, for the most part, in the corporate media in this country. There are rare exceptions to the bankruptcy of the corporate media when it comes to foreign reporting these days. One of them is Anthony Shadid, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, worked for The Washington Post, has recently been rehired by The New York Times. He's one of the few corporate reporters that actually unembeds himself from the U.S. Supremacy complex and goes over and spends time with ordinary Iraqis. He speaks the language, and so his reporting is great. What's entirely missing from the corporate media in this country, with few exceptions, is the story of what does it look like to live on the other side of the barrel of the gun that is U.S. foreign policy or U.S.-backed dictatorship somewhere. And that's just completely absent from our media culture, whereas it's the top story for most countries around the world, including in Britain and Canada, where they actually do report on those things. So I think that we live in a self-censoring society in the United States where corporate media is in the midst of a 1-2 punch to itself, where you've got self-censorship and then you have a slashing of foreign reporting budgets. So I think that if we can keep the internet free, and I know you've worked a lot on this, Bob, where we can make it free and make it accessible and have some kind of democracy in internet access, then I think that we're in a situation where we can really start to chisel away at the monopoly on media in this country. But that's a huge battle that we have to have right now. And free the internet, cable access, save it, and remind them constantly that the airwaves are public. They don't belong to any of those robber barons.
Jeremy Scahill, you have, I think, following very much in the way that Amy Goodman has approached American politicians and American politics, have pretty much, I think, as far as I can tell, had this exact same standard of judgment for any presidential administration, regardless of party. You have not been really carrying water for anyone, going back to the Clinton era. And I'm interested, therefore, in your assessment of the Obama administration and its handling of policy in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Middle East, and now Pakistan, and how that is similar to what the Bush 43 administration did and how it's different, and your assessment of it.
Well, I mean, it's refreshing to have a president that actually, you know, can speak with some mastery of the English language. Bush certainly couldn't do that. And in a way, it's great to have a president that you feel actually is intelligent and isn't going to be batting yarn in the Oval Office while, you know, Dick Cheney and his cronies make decisions. But when we get past the sort of superficial layer of how refreshing it is to have Obama rather than Bush as president, and you actually look at policy, which is what journalists should be doing, not looking at personality, but looking at policy, actions, not words, what you find is that when it comes to the issue of war, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Obama administration has dramatically escalated the U.S. conflict in Pakistan to dangerous levels. You have U.S. covert operations on an ongoing basis happening in Pakistan that are ultimately destabilizing that country and pushing it closer to the brink of some kind of a severe catastrophe. In Afghanistan, Obama has radically increased the number of troops in that country, U.S. troops and mercenaries, and has continued this process of using private forces. In Iraq, we have seen over the past several weeks a return to very disturbing what appear to be ethnic-based killings that are happening, including some that are carried out by people that are speaking English wearing military uniforms. And that's a blowback or a flashback to 2005 when there was this ethnic cleansing happening in Baghdad. So what we're seeing is that the Obama administration has either maintained the status quo of Bush's bad policies regarding war or has actually been worse than Bush in the case of Afghanistan in some areas. On the issue of civil liberties in this country, the Obama administration has gone into court in several cases where the Center for Constitutional Rights or the ACLU are either fighting for documents or fighting for habeas corpus rights of prisoners, and has put on record positions from the Obama Justice Department that are in some cases worse than the Bush administration's positions on these very same issues. Obama also has made much further reaching statements about the right of the United States to preemptively detain people, take them prisoner, and hold them indefinitely without charge. And Obama did that while standing in front of the original copy of the U.S. Constitution. My friend Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said that Obama wrapped himself in the Constitution that day and then proceeded to trample on the Constitution when he did that. So, and then we have the health care plan. There has not been a time in recent history when the Democrats had greater control over the U.S. government. Solid majorities in both houses and a Democrat in the White House, they could have pushed through at least a public option with this health care, and they probably could have thrown down the gauntlet and tried to go to war over single-payer health care. Instead, what we get is a huge bonus round for Big Pharma and to a large extent for the insurance lobby in the insurance industry. So these are just some examples of how Obama is either as bad as Bush or worse than Bush. Of course, there are areas where Obama is better than Bush, but they aren't necessarily on the bread and butter issues that matter to people in this country, regardless of how effective the spin operation is. And we find ourselves in this position where when you criticize Obama, you are doing so in the midst of a sea of vicious lies, of racism, of this Tea Party foolery that's you know, sort of engulfing the media in this country right now. And so people push back and say, well, Obama's already under attack, so you can't criticize him. So we have the principled criticisms of the administration and its policies unfortunately get lumped in with this craziness that all of us have an obligation to push back against that's coming from the right wing. So the short of what I'm trying to say here, Bob, is that it's a very complicated time to be a principled dissident because of the way that these partisan lines have been drawn in this country. If you're a nonpartisan individual, they try to lump you in with the Tea Party because you have the audacity to actually criticize a popular president and although I think that's the only way that things change is when you're consistent. You can't be one person one day and another the next day. If the war in Afghanistan was wrong when Bush did it, it has to be wrong when Obama does it too.
Jeremy Scahill, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. Jeremy Scahill, winner of the second Izzy Award, named after I.F. Stone, issued by Ithaca College. He'll be accepting that award tomorrow night in Ithaca, New York. The winners of the first year were Amy Goodman and Glenn Greenwald. He's also the author of Blackwater, the best-selling and award-winning book that came out first in 2007 and was updated a couple of years after that and is available in fine bookstores everywhere. This program is pre-recorded, so we ask ask that you not try to call and sit back and relax. And Jeremy, I think this conversation about Obama administration and the standards, holding them to the same standard that we hold the Bush administration as journalists, as scholars, as citizens, really, and not sort of just try to play inside baseball and have situational standards. If we stand back, it seems that if you look at Obama's foreign policy and compare it to Bush 43, you know, as you said, there's not a great deal of difference. And you have to wonder at a certain point if maybe it's not the person of Barack Obama anymore, it was the person of Bill Clinton or the person of George W. Bush, if they're just large structural factors that push pretty much whoever's in power to pursue the same policies.
Well, I mean, I think that you can draw a sort of perfect trajectory going back really to the Reagan administration to the present. I mean, U.S. policy has remained pretty consistent when it comes to foreign policy from the time of Reagan to Obama. And the major initiatives, I mean, the privatization program that seeps into every aspect of our life has always been a bipartisan program. The notion of America first foreign policy, this U.S. exceptionalism, has been embraced by every president, and Obama is no different. The U.S. posture toward Israel has remained the same, with Obama kicking it off even before he was elected, going to AIPAC and, you know, paying homage at the altar of AIPAC. U.S. economic policy, where you have an utter reliance on the myths of free market liberation, that somehow if you just free the markets around the world, that freedom is going to follow. The best way I can think of to put it is that Obama has continued the global tradition of the United States hammering countries militarily with an iron fist to protect the hidden hand of the free market. And when it comes to domestic policy, you have an erosion of workers' rights. You have an erosion of media freedom that unfortunately is supported by many big-time journalists. And you have policies on immigration, on poverty, on health care that are not aimed at actually any kind of justice, but oftentimes are viewed through the prism of how it would affect corporate profits. And so, yes, I think you're right. This isn't about Obama as a man. He's chosen to become a part of that game, and he's playing his role exceptionally well. Obama's done things that John McCain could have only dreamed of doing because he would have found resistance from progressives. Obama's able to kind of tamp down resistance and to push through things and policies that are being defended by liberals instead of being confronted. And I think the Republicans, in the words of William Kristol, are just gobsmacked by how good things have been under Obama for them.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And, you know, as you look at American politics today, and you're an observer of it, what are the encouraging signs?
Well, I think the part of what's happened because of how vitriolic and vicious the Republicans have become is that I think that you have more people that are being spurred to kind of stand up and pay attention and push back. I think that the health care debate in this country resulted in an expansion of the single-payer movement where you saw, I mean, I was there with you at Fighting Bob Fest in Wisconsin some months ago, and I was impressed at how many people were out there with a very clear platform addressing health care. I think people are getting more engaged again. I think that people are engaging more in social media. I think it's a positive that we have Rachel Maddow on the air on MSNBC. Although I disagree with a lot of the partisan yin yang on MSNBC, I think that we have some glowing instances of great media people that have a nightly presence right now. With the Obama administration, I think that it's a positive. It was a positive move for Obama to direct federal agencies to be more responsive to requests for information, for Freedom of Information Act requests. The sad thing, though, is that we're seeing the same kind of stonewalling that happened during the Bush administration. So what I would say is that there are positive tones being struck by the Obama administration on several key issues. But when they come to the point of policy, unfortunately, they fall far short. So this is a long-winded way of saying, Bob, that I think that grassroots activism seems to be slightly increasing once again, and I think it's a twofold thing. One, because of the vitriolic, hateful nature of the right wing and of Republicans, and the other is because Obama's letting down a lot of progressives who are finally waking up and ripping off the Obama T-shirt and saying, wait, this isn't right.
Our guest, Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy, Chris Hedges, the former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning author, who now also writes for The Nation, works at The Nation Institute, has written a new book, and he's been a guest on this program, and he's written widely, a very dour and grim view of the fate of the United States, which basically says that people are basically morons. The culture has produced a nation of people really incapable of critical thought, and it's fairly despondent and sort of ties in certain ways, ironically or coincidentally, with sort of the dominant view that people are morons and therefore should be treated as morons. And, you know, this argument that Hedges makes, which is comes from, I would say, the political left in his view, certainly, is really, I've noticed in my travels around the country, is not an unfamiliar argument. It resonates with a lot of people who are deeply concerned about the idea that their fellow country people are, in their view, you know, idiots. You must hear this, too, and that's the cause of our problems. How do you respond to that? And what's your take on the argument?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think this is a little bit more, and I know Chris and have a lot of respect for him, but I do think it's a little bit more complicated than he presents it. And I'm familiar with his work, and I'm familiar with this line that he takes. You know, I'm from the Midwest, though. I'm not from one of the coasts. And I think that, you know, one of the things you learn when you're in the Midwest is, you know, you meet people that a lot of them are blue-collar folks. They work for a living. You know, they're not embedded in New York City like I am these days, where they can be insulated by their, you know, clique of academics and intellectuals and others who can pontificate about how stupid everyone else is. I think when you have an experience where you actually have friends that aren't journalists or aren't academics, then you learn something a little bit deeper about what's happening in this country, and that is that a lot of people don't have the luxury of doing what you do, Bob, or what I do. Because their training is in a different trade, and they're struggling to make ends meet. And so, to them, paying attention to what's happening in Afghanistan or Iraq is not the primary thing going on in their life. It certainly is the primary thing going on in my life. So I think we have to be really careful in sort of collectively declaring this a nation of morons. I think that there are people that would love to have the luxury of being able to read more, spend more time being informed. But I also think that there is a part of this that I agree with Chris about, and that is that we have a media culture that almost in a conspiratorial nature seems to have as its goal making people stupid, making them think that what happens in the life of Sandra Bullock's husband or what happens with Tiger Woods is somehow reality, or the Real Housewives of New York, that's reality, but what happens in Iraq isn't. And I do think that that is dumbing down our culture collectively, because the options out there are either dumb or dumber. But I don't think that I think that Chris underestimates a lot of people in this country, and I think that the healthcare debate has shown that a lot of ordinary folks that normally don't participate in politics have risen up to try to have their voices be heard on this. And I think we have to be mindful of how do we reach out to people that don't live in the insulated world of journalists and academics, and meet them on their own terms and on their own turf. And I think that would be one of the major criticisms I would have of journalists who write off the country as a country of morons. What have we done to reach out and see what's happening in their lives? The struggle to make ends meet and feed families is more important to them than knowing what's going on in Iraq or Afghanistan. You can't blame them.
Jeremy Scahill, you've already referred a couple times now to the Tea Party, which sort of is the dominant theme in the news media of American politics, the emergence of this movement almost immediately upon the inauguration or even preceding the inauguration of Barack Obama and the Democrats coming to power in Washington. And what's your sense as you look at this movement? What do you make of it? What do you make of its politics, of what it's based on? Is it a proto-fascist movement? Is it a populist movement? Is it a corporate-driven movement? What's your sense?
I would say that, you know, if you took the absolute best element of what's loosely called the Tea Party. And you sort of wanted to say, extract from this, like, what's a good thing you could say about these people? I would say that you have a tiny minority of people within the Tea Party that that would identify themselves as traditional conservatives and would be anti expansionist in terms of U.S. foreign policy, have a, albeit a different view than I do, but a view that you could respect when it comes to, you know, U.S. economic policy and you know, small government, etc. The people that sort of in one way or another maybe were a part of the Ron Paul presidential campaign, and I think Ron Paul also is a lunatic in a lot of ways, who happened to say some good things during the campaign. That would be the best thing I could say about the Tea Party, is that some elements of the kind of anti-war, anti-corporate parts of the Tea Party movement. However, having said that, I largely believe that the Tea Party is a movement of racists, and is astroturf, is not actually grassroots, is run by people like Dick Armey, is run by the lobby of big corporations, is a fake grassroots movement that is taking advantage of the stupidity of a lot of people who are racists, who regularly, because they've been convinced to do so, vote against their own self-interest on economic policy, and also has at its core this need to fuel a machine of hatred toward a black president who's implementing policies that 12 years ago would have been the policies of the Republican Party. So yeah, I do think we live in an environment where you have fascist, racist-type elements that are masquerading as grassroots movements. And I think you have a president in office now who's received more death threats than any president in U.S. history. I think it's because he's a black man. And this stuff about socialists, you know, is complete nonsense. I wish Obama was a socialist, because we would actually have people, we wouldn't have people sleeping on the streets in this country, and people would have meals to eat, and people would start to have some kind of meaningful work in their life. But he's not a socialist. And I think that the Tea Party movement, encouraged by Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and others, is largely a racist movement of people that are crazy and voting against their own self-interest in the case of so-called ordinary people that join them.
You've also, Jeremy Scahill, mentioned the emergence of programs like Rachel Maddow, and there's Keith Olbermann's show also on MSNBC, which has become sort of the liberal counterbalance to Fox and has enjoyed a measure of success. And you've appeared, I know, as a guest on those shows. And you've also been a correspondent for the HBO version, Bill Maher's comedy show that's on, has been on now for like 8 or 9 years. And so from your experience, what are the strengths and weaknesses of those as sort of an alternative media realm?
Well, you know, I'll start with the Bill Maher experience. You know, on Bill Maher, I was on, you know, with one of the last shows I was on was with Chuck Todd, who's the, you know, famous NBC political director / senior White House correspondent. And I was able to confront him about statements he made disparaging of those calling for accountability for torture under the Bush administration. And I was put on a program where I was sitting with Chuck Todd and Jay Leno. And Jay Leno actually turned into a kind of interviewer on the program, and really, we saw a side of him that had seldom been seen before. I got so much feedback from that one moment of confronting a corporate celebrity journalist on something that he had said that was outrageous, that showed that people in this country are starving for independent media that can be broadcast to a much wider audience.
And let me interrupt you if I can for a second, yeah. Jeremy, because I saw that episode and I talked to friends about it. What was stunning about it, among other things, was how exceptionally defensive and dismissive Todd was at simultaneously.
Right. I mean, here it was. And I mean, the thing is, people can, you know, you can look for it on YouTube or whatever, just, you know, Google my name and Chuck Todd's or Bill Maher or what have you. But the basic point was, all I did was simply say, why don't you people that have access to the powerful ever ask them a relevant question? Why don't you ask them about the war? Why don't you ask them about this? And I confronted Chuck Todd about something specific he had said, and I didn't do it in a hostile way. I just brought it up with him, and he went bananas about it. You know, because these guys are not used to having to endure any criticism of their work. They are the ones that are conveying to the American people the information they need to know. And so when somebody they've never heard of, like myself, has the audacity to question the veracity of what they're doing as quote-unquote journalists, they have such thin skin about it. And so, I mean, that was an incredible thing to be a part of, because after the show, Chuck Todd accused me of sullying his reputation on TV. He literally said, "You sullied my reputation on TV." No, Chuck, you sullied your own. You sully your own reputation by acting like a stenographer every day for the powerful. But to answer your question, though, about Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow, I love Keith Olbermann. I love Rachel Maddow. What I don't love, though, is how there are flashes or moments where they turn into blue state Fox News, where they sound like spokespeople for the White House. And I think that, you know, when they're at their best, they're amazing. But there are moments when I think they do a disservice to independent journalism by imitating Fox News' dedication to, you know, everything that would come out of the Bush White House by doing that with the Obama White House. There's no need. Rachel Maddow is probably the smartest person on television today, and 90% of what she does is phenomenal. I just think we have to keep ourselves in check about falling over ourselves regarding Obama when it comes to, you know, Maddow and Olbermann, if I could offer some humble advice.
Are you going to be back on the Maher show in the future, or was that stint sort of a short-termer?
No. I mean, I'm in touch with them, and they're, you know, I mean, I have a longstanding now relationship with them, and I think when it makes sense for me to be on, then they'll have me on. But you know, I was working for them as a correspondent briefly during the election, and then they've had me on as a panelist a few times. So I think, though, that I'd like to give other people a chance. I've been on that show maybe four or five times last mm-hmm. season, so you know, I would like for them to have other independent journalists on. Same goes for Maddow and Olbermann. I think that, you know, we need to get more of these grassroots reporters that are out there getting their fingernails dirty exposure. And I try to recommend people all the time in spot of myself on some shows, too. I think we need a diversity of voices.
Yeah, speaking with Jeremy Scahill, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I'd like you to take this opportunity to mention, identify some of the independent American journalists who, you know, you'd like to see get more recognition for their work, or media for that matter, where our listeners could go to and look for to see, you know, who's doing the good stuff out there.
Right. Well, I think, you know, first of all, I think it's an outrage that CNN hired this right-wing blogger, Eric Erickson from Red State, .com as part of the quote-unquote best political team on television. This is basically like co-signing hate speech, and I think that, you know, CNN should bring someone like Amy Goodman on to be part of the best political team on television, but they won't do that. You know, she occasionally will appear, but they just won't do it. I would point to the work of people like Jane Hampshire and Marcy Wheeler at FireDogLit.com. Marcy Wheeler is probably the best journalist in this country who's been covering the issue of torture as a U.S. policy, and yet you almost never see her name anywhere. She has a blog called Empty Wheel. I always think Glenn Greenwald is a great place to start in the morning. I like the folks over at Danger Room when it comes to defense policy. It's on Wired.com's website, but Danger Room is an incredible blog for those that are interested in sort of the nuances of U.S. foreign policy. I also think that people from the indie media centers around this country, and you can find links to various sites at indiemedia.org, remain a very, very important source for information. And Bob, in closing, I'll say that I'm going to be starting my own blog at thenation.com that's going to launch this month, where I'm really proud that Greg Mitchell, formerly of editor and publisher, is also going to be having a blog that deals with media issues, and so I'll look forward to the content he produces as well.
Yeah, Greg's been a guest on this show in the past, and we'll be monitoring that website and that blog and stay on top of it. Maybe get you guys back on the show later down the road to talk about it.
That'd be great.
Well, Jeremy Scahill, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for taking time from your very busy schedule to join us here at Media Matters.
Hey, Bob, and thank you, and congrats on the new book. I'm sure that it's going to be well-received, particularly by young people around the country who are aspiring to get into this game.
Well, thank you so much, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for producing today's show, Melissa Trentz for arranging it. We'll be back 1 week from today. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll have sunny skies today with a high of around 65 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear with patchy frost after midnight, a low of 35. Sunny skies on Monday with a high of 65, partly cloudy Monday night with a low of 38, and mostly sunny on Tuesday with a high of 65. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.